So the third aspect of non-displaceability is really about waking up personal agency in each of us, you know, getting us ready to go make something happen, but coupled with this external considering that we talked about, caring about our effects on others and especially social systems and planetary systems. So we're holding, you get a picture, I'm holding in one hand the idea of essence and the other idea of global imperatives. And I'm holding both of those and saying, all right, I need to deliver something in the world. And it could be, even if you're an employee inside of a company, you're looking to see who the stakeholders are to that business and how do you bring your essence coupled with the sense of what you and the company believes is a global imperative.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to thank our sponsor at Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. I have not been disappointed picking up new flavors of guayaki recently. Have you guys tried Bluephoria, by the way? It's really good. We're also glad that Guayaki continues to brew their mate-based goodness through this challenging time. Mate, it also turns out, contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. So it gives me the energy I want while also being a healthy choice. We hope you guys are going to check this out. It's a great beverage out with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So, Carol, we've talked a lot on the podcast about how to grow a business to become non-displaceable in the market. But we have yet to talk about the idea in the context of an individual. So I'm actually pretty excited to tackle this one because I think people have a common misconception about one of the paths to success is really about making themselves indispensable in their organization. In fact, I actually remember saying to myself in many jobs, you know, if I leave, this place goes down without me. So in the end, that was really more about my ego than it was the long-term viability of that business, though.
Yeah, so you can't tell I'm smiling, but I have heard people say that. Actually, the idea for this particular podcast came from a comment on Business Second Opinion Twitter feed. A young man, I believe, I actually can't tell who it is, but it was framed in a way that I was guessing, that he founded a company with someone else. And now they were having trouble. And he was trying to figure out how to make it clear in this partner relationship about his non-displaceability to the process versus one of them trying to push the other out. So he didn't give me an article, but I was intrigued by the question, just like you are. So I went to Harvard Business Review and I thought, well, let me see if I can find an article there. And I did. That was something we could give a second opinion to, because, of course, that's what we do. We don't share our own ideas and create an article and pontificate. We like to jump off of someone else's idea. So that's what we're doing today.
Cool. So before we get started here, let me just start by offering the article itself. So it's from the October 2011 issue of the Harvard Business Review, and it's titled Making Yourself Indispensable by John Zenger, Joseph Folkman, and Scott Edinger. I hope I'm pronouncing everyone's names appropriately. So just to give my quick impression here, this article leaned heavily more kind of into career advice about how to build one's own strengths. So the premise of the article, actually, as far as I could tell, was in order to make oneself indispensable to their organization as a leader, they need to develop more strengths that complement the strengths they already had. Because according to the data that these authors gathered, they had about 250,000 360-degree feedback responses. Through most of those things, what they saw is the more strengths the leader had, the better leadership feedback they would get. And so therefore being more indispensable in the organization, I guess. I don't know about you, but I'm still kind of finding it hard to understand the link between being indispensable, meaning, by the way, absolutely necessary, and developing more strengths. So maybe, Carol, you can help shine a light on this a little bit.
Well, you know, as I listen to you, it's almost as if they have no idea of what a really powerful way would be to be in the world. And so they just encourage people to augment what they already have. And I've never, I have to admit, never had much of a real job as an adult. So all of this kind of made me really sad that anyone would follow this advice of like building blocks, throw in some more. So Zach, just so people get an idea of what it would look like, or maybe has looked like for you, can you share what this has looked like? In other words, where were you already great at something? How would you follow their advice? I really would like to have a strong contrast of what it would look like to go down this path before we begin to offer an alternative.
Sure. So I've gotten a lot of feedback over the years, unfortunately, and particularly in my previous role at the hospital where I worked, there was a lot said to me that I was a strong leader because of a high level of integrity, and I was deeply caring for those around me, and I had a lot of what HR folks would call resiliency. So I was kind of like one of those clown balloons that you punch and they fall over and they kind of get back up that the kids use. So, or maybe if you're like a really old kid or something like that, like me. Okay. So if you look at the map, however, that the authors draw up, so I have like a lot of overlap with a number of those areas they highlight.
Yeah. Oh, I get that that path was not personally rewarding or fulfilling at any level, or you wouldn't have left off on a career path and been really, from what I understand, you told me at the time, you were offered a great deal that the employers were using to try and get you there. Can you make another level of cut on this so we could see why it was much more, well, what they did, how they tried to keep you there, and a little bit about what it left you feeling like?
Totally. So I think, you know, my employers actually followed suit with a lot of what the premises that this article is offering. So both in my time on Wall Street and then in healthcare, as I was leaving, my employers were upping the ante by offering me different roles and opportunities to try to keep me, right? So changing the reward structure. But I can tell you that I was definitely at the time living my idea of being indispensable, right? Because that's where they were offering all this stuff to me. But it was ultimately super deadening to me inside.
Yeah. And I know I was talking to you during that period of time. What would you say was missing? And the question is coming from a different way of looking at indispensable here. Companies trying to think about having their employees feel they are indispensable, what they were working like that from their perspective. But from your perspective, they were not indispensable to you and your life. So what was missing if you look at it from standing in the employee's perspective, and how does it relate to this advice here?
Yeah, totally. So I think at the end of the day, what was missing was that I could feel like I was actually or see or have the possibility of actually changing people's lives and how they work for the better, right? So the reward mechanisms within the business had stopped working on me, like the kind of rat feeder bar technique had kind of stopped working on me. And it was like there were certain aspects of the work design that were beyond my reach to help change. But the business itself just assumed that, you know, with enough money, they would, or a new title or something, they'd be able to keep me. And I think a lot of people fall for that trap. But on the other side, they realize deep down that there's still something missing, right, after the short-term buzz or reward wears off.
Yeah. And when I got this comment on Twitter about how do you deal with partnerships and indispensable in them, I realized that it really was a question which didn't necessarily just relate to business partners, but personal partners. And I was thinking it might be interesting to reflect on if you use that same theory that was in the Harvard Business article in your marriage, you know, another partnership. What would you try and add on to, you know, you've already got this being good. You got a marriage that's working really well, but what would you start to tack on to make it stronger and to feel indispensable to Alexa? And how would you feel about applying their advice in your personal life, or is something missing there also?
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. So that's a good question. So let's just actually try to use the chart a little bit. So in my marriage, my wife and I like work on ourselves and our relationship pretty continually, pretty constantly. So if I were to look at their chart and I pick one of my strengths, right? So one of the strengths they have up there is practices self-development. So, okay, so we do that already. I think we do a pretty good job of that. So let me pick that one. The other strengths, therefore, I should look at are kind of on the wings of either side. So according to the chart, they are one side innovation and the other side focusing on results. So in the background, I'm sure you can hear my wife laughing already, but like, so it looks like I need to do things like be more, you know, create a high performance team or family, I guess. I don't know how that works, but provide more effective feedback to my wife and kids and provide rewards and recognition to them. Okay. So Carol, I'm just like saying this stuff out loud kind of gives me the creeps a little bit. So maybe you can help show our listeners a little bit of a different way to think about this.
Yeah. The whole idea of that chart just nearly broke my spirit. And that's what I meant when I said it was really sad. I really want us to offer a different worldview. And I want to use three windows into that world that might help our listeners really connect with what non-displaceability, which is a little less ego-driven, where rather than I'm indispensable, can I be in a place that I really fit? And everyone there knows I fit. And know that it can work personally, but it also can work for the person on Twitter who asked for this with his business partner, or it can work on positioning your business out in the market. So it can work well, and also it can come back and work for the person who's trying to be better in their job. So we'll work on the same situation from different windows.
Okay, great. So where do we start?
Oh, okay. So let's look at these different ways of considering non-displaceability, or as they say, indispensability, as I said, from three windows. So the first window, stop looking for strengths, especially on a list, and stop trying to get at those as advised in this article. Instead, and people will be able to hear this from how you even do your current business now. Look at who you deeply are, the seeking and embracing wholeness, what your essence is, and work from there. Because, as you said, no one else can be that. It occurs to me, maybe you could help us differentiate essence and strengths, Zach, because I know you think about that a lot.
Yeah. So strengths live at the level of personality, right? It's no mistake that kind of a strengths finder that I'm sure people know is a personality typology, essentially. So strengths show up as these little aspects of me, mirrored again at personality, that I've learned from my parents and the world around me. So I often find that actually my various personalities are the aspects of me that get in the way the most. So I think of essence as that immutable aspect of me that's actually innate. It's the core of me from which I can draw the most clear direction and guidance towards my own contribution. So that's what makes me, well, me and not anyone else.
Yeah. And it's also why that chart moves you completely away from who you are. Because it's all things that will activate personality trying to position itself. So talk for a second here about what would you call your essential self? In a couple of words, how does that show up in your business? It's not like I'm saying your essence determines your business or your job. No, essence should be able to express everywhere. And it should be, even in the worst conditions, essence can show up. But your current expression, I think, is really alive for you in your company.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if I had to articulate it in a couple words, it would probably be something along the lines of like seeking wholeness. I feel like my whole life I've been continually seeking to integrate what seem like fragmented or different aspects of myself that are actually just different windows on the same house of me, so to speak. So to that end, I'm always seeking to understand the whole of me and the whole of others and the whole of systems and the whole. Yeah. And so I guess, as opposed to a rather than starting from some fragment or characteristic or part of something.
Yeah. Why does that matter? Why is essence a really powerful window on being connected, being grounded, being valued in the world? And how does it relate to how it guides you?
Yeah, I think because no one can be me, right? So essence is about being unique. It's about being like a one of one or N of one, as you've said before. So if no one can be me, then no one can displace me. So it's inherently connected to the idea of this whole article, right? Because if I start from this idea of seeking wholeness to source where I might begin something, the offerings that actually come from that essence are imbued with that uniqueness. Okay, so like in our business, we always start with a whole, most often a story or a world or, you know, something like that as a jumping off point, but it always needs to be a whole. We rarely last with customers who push us to start from something generic or want us to do cool moves, kind of quote unquote. So what's worse, if my business was offering the same thing that everyone else was, right? If like I was in the business of a commodity, why would a customer bother to buy something from me that they can get from anywhere, basically? Like, it seems like my business wouldn't last very long if I was trying to mimic everybody else. And how would I be able to stand out in the market or signal in the market with so much other noise going on?
You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm also thinking you're making so evident how displaceability is a question across everywhere there is a connection, a relationship. You talked a little bit about your wife. There's a little bit about you've got a business partner, right, you work with. Mm-hmm. But you've also got customers, which you work with. And you have to, in every case, be you, not be trying to position yourself in some way. So I think essence, if you don't start there, you can't go anywhere else. But let's talk about the second characteristic.
Okay.
So the second characteristic is a deep and meaningful external considering for others. Now, we've talked about external considering means it's not all about me. It is about being able to see my effects on others, on society, and on planetary processes like global warming. I call these global imperatives, and it's not our imperative. It is the planet's imperative or society. So what an imperative is and how it's understood is to understand how something works. So how does society work and what's imperative for that to happen? How does Earth work and what's imperative for it to be able to do her work? In other words, how do living systems work? The problem is we keep standing in anthropocentric, human-centered shoes and deciding what we should do. We should buy a certain kind of, set up certain kinds of supply chains and certain kinds of things for society. And we don't ask really, what is it that is really at work? What is the reality? And we fall into this solipsistic view of trying to make sense out of things. So Zach, what is the reference point in this article as you see it? And how does it drop out this core characteristic of being non-displaceable?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So the reference point of the article is written from the perspective of a middle manager actually trying to climb their way up the corporate ladder. So the premise they actually start from is in its sea of sameness, how do you get picked to move up? Right? Like that's the angle they're taking here. And the answer they ultimately give you is be more. And here's how, right? Here's how you can do more and be more. And here's the tools or here's the road to do that. So unfortunately, the answer they give you when looked at from our perspective is be more like everyone else, which seems to kind of fundamentally confound the premise. So this actually has nothing to do with anything beyond the walls of oneself or that company, right? The whole article is kind of kept in this bubble. And once again, Taylorism, Frederick Winslow Taylor, rears his ugly head here again. Apparently, in their world, your perspective as a worker ends at the walls of the company. So I think this is probably what's connected to the deadening part for myself here, and I think for most people. Like over time, your contribution doesn't actually mean much when it's always refracted through the company's success and nothing else. And I can tell you, I wouldn't last very long as a business owner if I didn't fundamentally consider the world outside.
Yeah. I came up with this idea of talking about global imperatives from listening to people who kept trying to add on their own do-good stuff, and they create sustainability departments or a program called Circular Economy or Donut or something that was outside of the strategy, outside of being a part of the business, and in a human being's life, outside of being a whole person. And I wanted to be able to have people really learn how much they project human values and human do-good statements onto a planet, onto Mother Earth at work, and onto society. And I push back to try and get them to come to the idea of really understanding, like, what does it take for democracy to work? How does democracy work? And slowly people came to the being able to stand in democracy's shoes, said, well, it's really about you have to have people who have critical thinking skills and can be self-managing and not waiting to be influenced by their group. But we don't develop that. And so we're going to create a global imperative, which we use to think about how do we help build critical thinking skills rather than dumb down our suppliers. We need to do the same thing as parents. So how does your work and your business take that idea into account where you actually get in the shoes of that which you're serving?
Yeah, so I think we work indirectly on a number of systems, but not the least of which is, like, this, for example, the system of masculine maturity, right? So we see ourselves as storytellers trying to offer stories in the world that act as a catharsis for a very specific audience. And sure, we make cool choreography, but cool has, honestly, it has like the shelf life of bread.
Yeah. All right. So the global imperative that you're working with is human beings are kind of incomplete. And because the gamers that joined your business are primarily men, you're looking at how do you help them grow up, how they become more complete, and that in they're able to express themselves in the world. That's a powerful global imperative. But most people who are doing gaming are not thinking about that. And you can see how that comes out of your essence, as you expressed it earlier, like this seeking and embracing wholeness, help them be more whole. All right. So the third aspect of non-displaceability is really about waking up personal agency in each of us, you know, getting us ready to go make something happen, but coupled with this external considering that we talked about, caring about our effects on others, and especially social systems and planetary systems. So we're holding, you get a picture. I'm holding in one hand the idea of essence and the other idea of global imperatives. And I'm holding both of those and saying, all right, I need to deliver something in the world. And it could be, even if you're an employee inside of a company, you're looking to see who the stakeholders are to that business and how do you bring your essence coupled with a sense of what you and the company believes is a global imperative. So let me give you an example. There's a Google Maps engineer. He's moved on now, but David Thau had an essence pattern, or still does, I'm sure, of being a pattern tracker. He would make sense out of all sorts of things by looking at the patterns that were left behind from how people worked, you know, kind of like tracking deer. And so his essence was tracking patterns in living systems. He was very interested also in indigenous people having a home that was naturally filled with life as it had been for centuries. And he was very drawn to South America. So a global imperative for human, non-human, natural systems being in harmony was a very important thing for him. How do you get those to work harmoniously? And he was also always researching to see what was the intersection of my two hands here, my essence, right? And that global imperative on helping build a better Amazon tribal way of living. And then he would work to create an offering to help make that happen using Google Maps. So in his job, so he's bringing himself, he's bringing a global imperative, but he's also looking at the people who get served by this, primarily governments who were buying this to try and help track. So for example, one thing Dave built was this great Google Maps app that was able to track changes, and they did it with other technology coupled with it, but were able to track changes in oxygen levels and forest health using the apps on mobile phones. The documentation that showed up in the app was able to be transferred directly to governing officials who cared about this, and particularly ensuring contracts were adhered to by foreign oil companies. The results of the tracking that the folks who lived out there in the forest was done, coupled with the other technology, was considered by the courts and the government certified proof of adherence to the contract or violation. Now, he was the go-to engineer during that time that I worked with him through a Google Innovation Lab, and he was totally indispensable, but he was non-displaceable and helped the company be that way for the work they did. And he actually used all three of these windows daily.
Yeah, so for our listeners at home, right? So an easy way that I've found, for example, to notice when these kind of three aspects are working is to also look at when they aren't, right? So let's look at David's situation again, right? So if David had started from a StrengthsFinder test rather than his own essence, he would probably have looked at his technical expertise as a strength and then followed the author's advice to either innovate, which is pretty abstract, or communicate his ideas more broadly. So I don't know what that means. I doubt, honestly, his perspective on indigenous peoples would have played a role here or even shown up in this, right? If you look at the map that they have. So if he was only looking at the company goals instead of global imperatives, I doubt the Amazon would have even come up on his radar, right? Or even been as focused on as, like, say, Google's or his team's internal KPIs. And if you invert personal agency, the connection between the two would have been totally broken. So he'd either be out trying to engineer for his own wallet or the next quarterly review or the next quarterly earnings report or what have you. And I think I've probably, just in that few sentences here, described a lot of engineers' worlds.
Yeah, I think you're right. So let me tell you how he got to that intersection, where you can probably see his essence as a pattern tracker, and you can see the global imperative of being able to help healthy, vital, living systems. But in the partnership, the role that he played was to figure out, you know, how it was that he was going to design things that really came off of Google's expertise. And here are some kind of ways that you might ask that question. So he started with, what is it that the beneficiary, and in this case, it turned out not only be the indigenous folks who lived in the Amazon, but the government leaders who were trying to get something to happen. What is it the beneficiaries most needed as the next step in their learning and their contribution into the world of their life? So he's asking about their life. And of course, they needed this development, this certifiable material they could take in. But he asked, could he do that? And the answer was he didn't know how to do it now. So he asked not only what they needed, but how could he use it to develop himself? So part of being non-displaceable is finding what they really need, but making it and stepping it up in such a high way, it helps you really be able to apply it. And then he would say, and I, because of my essence, am most able to provide that. So if we always look for a place that we can make a real difference that makes a difference, and they made a difference was the certifiable. He figured out how to do that. And then it allowed the essence expression of his customer, supplier, partner, whoever it is you're putting in there. And it's so big that he has to grow himself to do it. And it fits what he uniquely, only he and Google could uniquely do, and what was needed for the best outcome for all. So you can see why he was totally non-displaceable. And only when he chose to leave did he go and create his own new business. But the real key here was not the sideways to look at how do I add to what I already know to do. So, Zach, how does that strike you as you listen to me speak about him and his work, and particularly this third foundational window of bringing together beneficiaries, you know, their specific need, your development, your essence? What does this speak to in terms of how you think about non-displaceability and maybe how does it, what's missing from the article?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, right, the article gives a list of abstract ideas of how I could be based on nothing that has anything to do with me. In the end, it creates more kind of a flattening of sameness, right? Like all of the things I could be in the world are on that list. That seems kind of crazy to think about, actually. And what's worse, what difference does any of that make? Apparently, all I'm meant to do and be as a human is be more like other people so I can move up the corporate ladder. No wonder this approach makes me and other people feel dead inside.
So I'm very curious about when you think about your essence and the beneficiaries you're working with. How do you see that you are bringing more of who you are, this embracer, seeker of wholeness, and how it is you're bringing the global imperative of maturation of the masculine species into this? Where do you see this company and how does it bring life to you and to them as a result of that?
Well, I can tell you there are moments when we're beginning a new project and even along the way where because we've done so much work up front to think about the whole of the thing, it's almost like we're already anticipating down the road where we're going to fall into a ditch, right? And then because we're always focused on the story of the thing and the meaning behind it, the whole process in and of itself is not only meaningful for me, but meaningful for all involved. So it's like as we're moving through the entire process, I'm gaining will and more will, and it continues to build on itself as I go because the entire thing feels like it's a moving whole rather than some piece that I'm trying to wrestle to the ground. I don't know if that makes sense, but I feel like that's what I'm trying to get at.
No, that's great. I was thinking about how this whole thing fits me because I've got few aspects of essence, but the one that we refer to all the time is this contrarian. And what that really is about is disrupting certainty because people get lodged in some idea they had, whether or not they ever tested it. And so my whole life has been about helping people learn to dislodge their certainty because I believe we don't have a planet that works. We don't have a democracy that works. We don't have families or schools or any institutions unless people can become unattached and they can develop their thinking capacity. So I generated communities that people can join where they have made a decision that they're really ready to do that first for themselves and then for others. And I don't know of anybody else who can do what I do the way I do. And I know it's deeply needed because people stay for decades as a part of what I'm doing. And my life feels so rich and meaningful. So hopefully we've given some connection. Do you have any reflections on what I just said?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you're talking, it's funny. I had already kind of mentioned a lot of these ideas to my wife as I was going in and we started working on this. And I mean, just as a testament to our relationship and kind of how you work, I actually was working on the questions and then I would reflect them over to my wife and we were both pausing and thinking really deeply about what was being asked here. So I think that alone speaks to the possibility of what can come from a perspective shift like this.
I think you're right. So what we'd like to encourage people to do as of today is first, you let go of the whole idea of strengths. Those are things that are conditioned. They're part of personality. They don't give you a great future. And if you climb up a ladder, it may be a very dissatisfying, unfulfilling, or certainly limited to only function and maybe a financial return. If what you want is meaning and making a huge difference, you want to come from who you are. And that takes some work playing around with to discover. It's why we hang out and do that in our communities to help people grok what that is. And we also, instead of separating out how we take care of the planet and social systems and people, we embed it and teach our business members how to make it global imperatives from the systems experience, not from the humans, and then how to find those implicate intersections like you did with your business and like David Thau did with his work in Google, but also in his own new ventures and how I have done that. And so that's how it is you become non-displaceable in the world, because you're providing something that makes a difference. It works from you, and it helps bring something that everyone feels like, ah, that's what we should be working on.
So it's that time again. We have our 2020 summit coming up November 17th, all virtual, of course. And the subject this time is the Regenerative Governing Board. Bring some or all of your board of directors or advisors, any one of the role of governors or other similar bodies. Join the Regenerative Business Summit November 17th, as it's going to be far more than commercial enterprise. It's going to be not-for-profit, advisory, and more. Learn how the idea of governing boards looks from the regenerative paradigm. And also, learn about the five ways to change that regenerative approach shifts in terms of how board elections or appointments happen, committee roles shift, the role with the business that has a seismic shift going on, and every other aspect of what's required by law, policy, regulations, or even how ethics and moral choice are re-envisioned and restructured, including, and don't forget these, how financial effectiveness, investment, and social justice have a new platform for giving guidance. You can find out more by joining Carol's newsletter at carolsanford.com to get more information.
And we also have a new seed community that's just for individuals. What Zach is talking about is what we do with businesses, but we have one called the Regenerative Educator Community. And it's for anyone who helps, like I'm an educator. And part of what you can do that in any kind of institution, organization, profession, and the community, which people can join, enables us to learn to work with a developmental epistemology. That is, people knowing who they are, they set up their own way of learning, follow their own path, test ideas, and they are in a world they consider helping make people more intelligent in all the broad ways that means. You would get a very strong move from the expert view to the developmental view, and we build off the seven first principles of regeneration. So if that interests you, or you know someone who would be interested, go to seed-communities.com to learn more, and look under the Regenerative Life offerings. And we've extended the founder's fee, which can then be grandmothered in at a low rate, until October 15th.
So dear listeners, we need you. Here are the four ways you could help us. First of all, recommend an article or business practice on which you want a second opinion by emailing Carol at carol@businesssecondopinion.com with the article and subject. Second, please tell your friends to listen. We want to triple our audience this season, so help us get the word out. Third, please give us a review. People read them, and it helps us a lot for people to know what we do. And fourth, if you can help us fund the production cost of our show, that would be awesome. It costs about $10,000 per year for technical help, platforms, recording equipment, and the like. So on our website, there's a way to donate. You can donate once or pledge via Patreon for recurring support, totally an amount of your choosing. Just click the button one time and you're good to go.
And of course, keep listening yourself to Business Second Opinion. We are constantly reading, we're listening to what you tell us, and we're bringing a regenerative paradigm and regenerative worldview of practices to it. If you want to read more in-depth on the current publication, The Regenerative Life has been out since March, right in the middle of a crazy world. And if you want to create a book club, you can buy it in bulk and you get an executive workbook, which is like 80 pages of things you can do with your organization. And then you'll also see there are some free online workshops that go with that book purchase. Go check that out at carolsanford.com under books.
And if you want to get one of our Get a Second Opinion mugs, please send us an article suggestion or topics on practices and business for there you want a second opinion. You can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at @biz_second_opinion. If we use it to develop an episode, you get a mug.
And thanks to Numi Tea. They sponsor our Business Second Opinion notes, the show notes, which are on the website for our Business Second Opinion. And Babson College sponsors the summit, the Regenerative Business Summit, and the Regenerative Business Prize annually. So you can find out more about that also on Business Second Opinion webpage. And thanks also to Numi T for being a champion of our podcast and all of the work we do with the summit.
This has been Business Second Opinion.